Resignation? Tengo stared at her little hands, which were balled into fists. There is one other problem, though, the professor said to Tengo. You and this Mr. Komatsu plan to publish Air Chrysalis and present Iri to the public as a novelist, but she's dyslexic. Did you know that? I got the general idea on the train this morning. She was probably born that way. In school, they think she suffers from a kind of retardation, but she's actually quite smart, even wise in a very profound way. Still, her dyslexia can't help your plan, to put it mildly. How many people know about this? Aside from Eri herself, three, the professor said. There's me, of course, my daughter Azami, and you. No one else knows. You mean to say her teachers don't know? No, they don't. It's a little school in the countryside. They've probably never even heard of dyslexia. And besides, she only went to school for a short time. Then we might be able to hide it. The professor looked at Tengo for a while, as if judging the value of his face. Eri seems to trust you, he said a moment later. I don't know why, but she does. And I... Tengo waited for him to continue. And I trust Eri. So if she says it's all right to let you rewrite her novella, all I can do is give my approval. On the other hand, if you really do plan to go ahead with this scheme, there are a few things you should know about Eri. The professor swept his hand lightly across his right knee several times, as if he had found a tiny piece of thread there. What her childhood was like, for example, and where she spent it, and how I became responsible for raising her. This could take a while to tell. I'm listening, Tengo said. Next to him on the sofa, Fuka Eri sat up straight, still holding the collar of her cardigan closed at the throat. All right, then, the professor said. The story goes back to the 60s. Eri's father and I were close friends for a long time. I was 10 years older, but we both taught in the same department at the same university. Our personalities and worldviews were very different, but for some reason we got along. Both of us married late, and we both had daughters shortly after we got married. We lived in the same faculty apartment building, and our families were always together. Professionally, too, we were doing very well. People were starting to notice us as rising stars of academe. We often appeared in the media. It was a tremendously exciting time for us. Toward the end of the 60s, though, things started to change for the worse. The second renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty was coming in 1970, and the student movement was opposed to it. They blockaded the university campuses, fought with the riot police, had bloody factional disputes, and, as a result, people died. All of this was more than I wanted to deal with, and I decided to leave the university. I had never been that temperamentally suited to the academic life, but once these protests and riots began, I became fed up with it. Establishment, anti-establishment, I didn't care. Ultimately, it was just a clash of organizations, and I simply didn't trust any kind of organization, big or small. You, I would guess, were not yet old enough to be in the university in those days. No, the commotion had all died down by the time I started. The party was over, you mean? Pretty much. The professor raised his hands for a moment and then lowered them to his knees again. So, I quit the university, and 2 years later, Eri's father left. At the time, he was a great believer in Mao Zedong's revolutionary ideology and supported China's cultural revolution. We heard almost nothing in those days about how terrible and inhumane the cultural revolution could be. It even became trendy with some intellectuals to hold up Mao's Little Red Book. Eri's father went so far as to organize a group of students into a kind of Red Guard on campus, and he participated in the strike against the university. Some student believers on other campuses came to join his organization, and for a while, under his leadership, the faction became quite large. Then the university got the riot police to storm the campus. He was holed up there with his students, so he was arrested with them, convicted, and sentenced. This led to his de facto dismissal from the university. Eri was still a little girl then, and probably doesn't remember any of this. Fuka Eri remained silent. Her father's name is Tamotsu Fukada. After leaving the university, he took with him 10 core students from his Red Guard unit, and they entered the Takashima Academy. Most of the students had been expelled from the university. They all needed someplace to go, and Takashima Academy was not a bad choice for them. The media paid some attention to their movements at the time. Do you know anything about this? Tengo shook his head. No, nothing. Fukada's family went with him, meaning his wife and Eri here. They all entered Takashima together. You know about the Takashima Academy, don't you? In general, Tengo said, it's organized like a commune. They live a completely communal lifestyle and support themselves by farming. Dairy farming, too, on a national scale. They don't believe in personal property and own everything collectively. That's it. Fukada was supposedly looking for a utopia in the Takashima system, the professor said with a frown. But utopias don't exist, of course, anywhere, in any world, like alchemy or perpetual motion. What Takashima is doing, if you ask me, is making mindless robots. They take the circuits out of people's brains that make it possible for them to think for themselves. Their world is like the one that George Orwell depicted in his novel. I'm sure you realize that there are plenty of people who are looking for exactly that kind of brain death. It makes life a lot easier. You don't have to think about difficult things. Just shut up and do what your superiors tell you to do. You never have to starve. To people who are searching for that kind of environment, the Takashima Academy may well be utopia. But Fukada is not that kind of person. He likes to think things out for himself, to examine every aspect of an issue. That's how he made his living all those years. It was his profession. He could never be satisfied with a place like Takashima. He knew that much from the start. Kicked out of the university with a bunch of book-smart students in tow, he didn't have anywhere else to go, so he chose Takashima as a temporary refuge. What he was looking for there was not utopia, but an understanding of the Takashima system. The first thing they had to do was learn farming techniques. Fukada and his students were all city people. They didn't know any more about farming than I know about rocket science. And there was a lot for them to learn. Distribution systems, the possibilities and limits of a self-sufficient economy, practical rules for communal living, and so on. They lived in Takashima for 2 years, learning everything they could. After that, Fukada took his group with him, left Takashima, and went out on his own. Takashima was fun, Fuka Eri said. The professor smiled. I'm sure Takashima is fun for little children. But when you grow up and reach a certain age and develop an ego, life in Takashima for most young people comes close to a living hell. The leaders use their power to crush people's natural desire to think for themselves. It's foot-binding for the brain. Foot-binding? Fuka Eri asked. In the old days, in China, they used to cram little girls' feet into tiny shoes to keep them from growing, Tengo explained to her. She pictured it to herself, saying nothing. The professor continued. The core of Fukada's splinter group, of course, was made up of ex-students who were with him from his Red Guard days. But others came forward, too, so the size of the group snowballed beyond anyone's expectations. A good number of people had entered Takashima for idealistic reasons, but were dissatisfied and disappointed with what they found. People who had been hoping for a hippie-style communal life, leftists scarred by the university uprisings, people dissatisfied with ordinary life and searching for a new world of spirituality, single people, people who had their families with them like Fukada, a motley crew if ever there was one, and Fukada was their leader. He had a natural gift for leadership, like Moses leading the Israelites. He was smart, eloquent, and had outstanding powers of judgment. He was a charismatic figure, a big man, just about your size, come to think of it. People placed him at the center of the group as a matter of course, and they followed his judgment. The professor held out his arms to indicate the man's physical bulk. Fukaeri stared first at the professor's arms and then at Tengo, but she said nothing. Fukada and I are totally different, both in looks and personality. But even given our differences, we were very close friends. We recognized each other's abilities and trusted each other. I can say without exaggeration that ours was a once-in-a-lifetime friendship. Under Tamotsu Fukada's leadership, the group had found a depopulated village that suited their purposes in the mountains of Yamanashi Prefecture. The village was on the brink of death. The few old people who remained there could not manage the crops themselves and had no one to carry on the farm work after they were gone. The group was able to purchase the fields and houses for next to nothing, including the vinyl greenhouses. The village office provided a subsidy on condition that the group continue to cultivate the established farmland, and they were granted preferential tax treatment for at least the first few years. In addition, Fukada had his own personal source of funds, but Professor Ebisuno had no idea where the money came from. Fukada refused to talk about it, and he never revealed the secret to anybody, but somewhere he got hold of a considerable amount of cash that was needed to establish the commune. They used the money to buy farm machinery and building materials, and to set up a reserve fund. They repaired the old houses by themselves and built facilities that would enable their 30 members to live. This was in 1974. They called their new commune Sakigake, or Forerunner. Sakigake? The name sounded familiar to Tengo, but he couldn't remember where he might have heard it before. When his attempt to trace the memory back ended in failure, he felt unusually frustrated. The professor continued. Fukada was resigned to the likelihood that the operation of the commune would be tough for the first several years, until they became accustomed to the area. But things went more smoothly than he had expected. They were blessed with good weather and helpful neighbors. People readily took to Fukada as leader, given his sincere personality, and they admired the hard-working young members they saw sweating in the fields. The locals offered useful advice. In this way, the members were able to absorb practical knowledge about farming techniques and learn how to live off the land. While they continued to practice what they had learned in Takashima, Sakigake also came up with several of their own innovations. For example, they switched to organic farming, eschewing chemical pesticides and growing their vegetables entirely with organic fertilizers. They also started a mail-order food service pitched directly to affluent urbanites. That way they could charge more per unit. They were the first of the so-called ecological farmers, and they knew how to make the most of it. Having been raised in the city, the commune's members knew that city people would be glad to pay high prices for fresh, tasty vegetables, free of pollutants. They created their own distribution system by contracting with delivery companies and simplifying their routes. They were also the first to make a virtue of the fact that they were selling ununiform vegetables with the soil still clinging to them. The professor went on. I visited Fukada on his farm any number of times. He seemed invigorated by his new surroundings and the chance to try new possibilities there. It was probably the most peaceful, hope-filled time of his life, and his family also appeared to have adapted well to this new way of living. More and more people would hear about Sakigake Farm and show up there wanting to become members. The name had gradually become more widely known through the mail-order business, and the mass media had reported on it as an example of a successful commune. More than a few people were eager to escape from the real world's mad pursuit of money and its flood of information, instead earning their living by the sweat of their brow. Sakigake appealed to them. When these people showed up, Sakigake would interview and investigate them, and give the promising ones membership. They couldn't admit everyone who came. They had to preserve the members' high quality and ethics. They were looking for people with strong farming skills and healthy physiques who could tolerate hard physical labor. They also welcomed women in hopes of keeping something close to a 50-50 male-female ratio. Increasing the numbers would mean enlarging the scale of the farm, but there were plenty of extra fields and houses nearby, so that was no problem. Young bachelors made up the core of the farm's membership at first, but the number of people joining with families gradually increased. Among the newcomers were well-educated professionals, doctors, engineers, teachers, accountants, and the like. Such people were heartily welcomed by the community, since their professional skills could be put to good use. Tengo asked, "Did the commune adopt Takashima's type of primitive communist system?" The professor shook his head. "No, Fukada avoided the communal ownership of property. Politically, he was a radical, but he was also a cool-headed realist. What he was aiming for was a more flexible community, not a society like an ant colony. His approach was to divide the whole into a number of units, each leading its own flexible communal life. They recognized private property and apportioned out compensation to some extent. If you weren't satisfied with your unit, you could switch to another one, and you were free to leave Sakigake itself any time you liked. There was full access to the outside world, too, and there was virtually no ideological inculcation or brainwashing. He had learned when they were in Takashima that a natural open system would increase productivity. Under Fukada's leadership, the operation of Sakigake Farm remained on track, but eventually the commune split into two distinct factions. Such a split was inevitable as long as they kept Fukada's flexible unit system. On one side was a militant faction, a revolutionary group based on the Red Guard unit that Fukada had originally organized. For them, the farming commune was strictly preparatory for the revolution. Farming was just a cover for them until the time came for them to take up arms. That was their unshakable stance. On the other side was the moderate faction. As the majority, they shared the militant faction's opposition to capitalism, but they kept some distance from politics, instead preferring the creation of a self-sufficient communal life in nature. Insofar as farming was concerned, each faction shared the same goals, but whenever it became necessary to make decisions regarding operational policy of the commune as a whole, their opinions split. Often they could find no room for rapprochement, and this would give rise to violent arguments. The breakup of the commune was just a matter of time. Maintaining a neutral stance became increasingly difficult with each passing day. Eventually, Fukada found himself trapped between the two factions. He was generally aware that 1970s Japan was not the place or time for mounting a revolution. What he had always had in mind was the potential of a revolution. Revolution as a metaphor or hypothesis. He believed that exercising that kind of anti-establishment, subversive will was indispensable for a healthy society. But his students wanted a real revolution, with real bloodshed. Of course, Fukada bore some responsibility for this. He was the one who had planted such baseless myths in their heads. But he never told them that his revolution had quotation marks around it. And so, the two factions of the Sakigake commune parted ways. The moderate faction continued to call itself Sakigake and remained in the original village, while the militant faction moved to a different, abandoned village a few miles away, and made it the base of their revolutionary movement. The Fukada family remained in Sakigake with all the other families. The split was a friendly one. It appears that Fukada obtained the funds for the new commune from his usual unspecified source. Even after their separation, the two farms maintained a cooperative relationship. They traded necessary materials and, for economic reasons, used the same distribution routes for their products. The two small communities had to help each other if they were to survive. One thing did change, however, shortly after the split. The effective cessation of visits between the old Sakigake members and the new commune. Only Fukada himself continued to correspond with his former radical students. Fukada felt a strong sense of responsibility for them, as the one who had originally organized and led them into the mountains of Yamanashi. In addition, the new commune needed the secret funds that Fukada controlled. Fukada was probably in a kind of schizoid state by then, the professor said. He no longer believed with his whole heart in the possibility or the romance of the revolution. Neither, however, could he completely disavow it. To do so would mean disavowing his life and confessing his mistakes for all to see. This was something he could not do. He had too much pride, and he worried about the confusion that would surely arise among his students as a result. At that stage, he still wielded a certain degree of control over them. This is how he found himself living a life that had him running back and forth between Sakigake and the new commune. He took upon himself the simultaneous duties of leader of one and advisor to the other. So, a person who no longer truly believed in the revolution continued to preach revolutionary theory. The members of the new commune carried on with their farm work while they submitted to the harsh discipline of military training and ideological indoctrination. And politically, in contrast to Fukada, they became increasingly radicalized. They adopted a policy of obsessive secrecy, and they no longer allowed outsiders to enter. Aware of their calls for armed revolution, the security police identified them as a group that needed to be watched and placed them under surveillance, though not at a high level of alert. The professor stared at his knees again, and then looked up. Sakigake split in two in 1976, he went on. Eri escaped from Sakigake and came to live with us the following year. Around that time, the new commune began calling itself Akebono. Tengo looked up and narrowed his eyes. Wait a minute, he said. Akebono. I'm absolutely certain I've heard that name too. But the memory was vague and incoherent. All he could grab hold of were a few fragmentary, fact-like details. This Akebono, didn't they cause some kind of big incident a while ago? Exactly, Professor Ebisuno said, looking at Tengo more intently than he had until now. We're talking about the famous Akebono, of course, the ones who staged the gun battle with the police in the mountains near Lake Motosu. Gun battle, Tengo thought. I remember hearing about that. It was big news. I can't remember the details, though, for some reason, and I'm confused about the sequence of events. When he strained to recall more, he experienced a wrenching sensation through his whole body, as though his top and bottom halves were being twisted in opposite directions. He felt a dull throbbing deep in his head, and the air around him suddenly went thin. Sounds became muffled, as though he were underwater. He was probably about to have an attack. "Is something wrong?" the professor asked with obvious concern. His voice seemed to be coming from a very great distance. Tengo shook his head and in a strained voice said, "I'm fine. It'll go away soon."
Chapter 11 Aomame. The human body is a temple. The number of people who could deliver a kick to the balls with Aomame's mastery must have been few indeed. She had studied kick patterns with great diligence and never missed her daily practice. In kicking the balls, the most important thing was never to hesitate. One had to deliver a lightning attack to the adversary's weakest point and do so mercilessly and with the utmost ferocity. Just as when Hitler easily brought down France by striking at the weak point of the Maginot Line. One must not hesitate. A moment of indecision could be fatal. Generally speaking, there was no other way for a woman to take down a bigger, stronger man one-on-one. This was Aomame's unshakable belief. That part of the body was the weakest point attached to, or rather hanging from, the creature known as man, and most of the time it was not effectively defended. Not to take advantage of that fact was out of the question. As a woman, Aomame had no concrete idea how much it hurt to suffer a hard kick in the balls, though judging from the reactions and facial expressions of men she had kicked, she could at least imagine it. Not even the strongest or toughest man, it seemed, could bear the pain and the major loss of self-respect that accompanied it. "It hurts so much you think the end of the world is coming right now. I don't know how else to put it," It's different from ordinary pain, said a man after careful consideration, when Al-Mami asked him to explain it to her. Al-Mami gave some thought to his analogy. The end of the world. Conversely, then, she said, would you say that when the end of the world is coming right now, it feels like a hard kick in the balls? Never having experienced the end of the world, I can't be sure, but that might be right, the man said, glaring at a point in space with unfocused eyes. There's just this deep sense of powerlessness. Dark, suffocating, helpless. Sometime after that, Al-Mama happened to see the movie On the Beach on late-night television. It was an American movie made around 1960. Total war broke out between the U.S. and the USSR, and a huge number of missiles were launched between the continents like schools of flying fish. The Earth was annihilated, and humanity was wiped out in almost every part of the world. Thanks to the prevailing winds or something, however, the ashes of death still hadn't reached Australia and the Southern Hemisphere, though it was just a matter of time. The extinction of the human race was simply unavoidable. The surviving human beings there could do nothing but wait for the end to come. They chose different ways to live out their final days. That was the plot. It was a dark movie offering no hope of salvation. Though watching it, Al-Mami reconfirmed her belief that everyone, deep in their hearts, is waiting for the end of the world to come. In any case, watching the movie in the middle of the night alone, Al-Mami felt satisfied that she now had at least some idea of what it felt like to be kicked in the balls. After graduating from a college of physical education, Al-Mami spent 4 years working for a company that manufactured sports drinks and health food. She was a key member of the company's women's softball team, ace pitcher, cleanup batter. The team did fairly well and several times reached the quarterfinals of the national championship playoffs. A month after Tamaki Otsuka died, though, Al-Mami resigned from the company and marked the end of her softball career. Any desire she might have had to continue with the game had vanished, and she felt a need to start her life anew. With the help of an older friend from college, she found a job as an instructor at a sports club in Tokyo's Suenkiro district. Al-Mami was primarily in charge of classes in muscle training and martial arts. It was a well-known, exclusive club with high membership fees and dues, and many of its members were celebrities. Al-Mami established several classes in her best area, women's self-defense techniques. She made a large canvas dummy in the shape of a man, sewed a black work glove in the groin area to serve as testicles, and gave female club members thorough training in how to kick in that spot. In the interest of realism, she stuffed 2 squash balls into the glove. The women were to kick this target swiftly, mercilessly, and repeatedly. Many of them took special pleasure in this training, and their skill improved markedly. But other members, mostly men, of course, viewed the spectacle with a frown and complained to the club's management that she was going overboard. As a result, Al-Mami was called in and instructed to rein in the ball-kicking practice. Realistically speaking, though, she protested, it's impossible for women to protect themselves against men without resorting to a kick in the testicles. Most men are bigger and stronger than women. A swift testicle attack is a woman's only chance. Mao Zedong said it best. You find your opponent's weak point and make the first move with a concentrated attack. It's the only chance a guerrilla force has of defeating a regular army. The manager did not take well to her passionate defense. You know perfectly well that we're one of the few truly exclusive clubs in the metropolitan area, he said with a frown. Most of our members are celebrities. We have to preserve our dignity in all aspects of our operations. Image is crucial. I don't care what the reason is for these drills of yours. It's less than dignified to have a gang of nubile women kicking a doll in the crotch and screeching their heads off. We've already had at least one case of a potential member touring the club and withdrawing his application after he happened to see your class in action. I don't care what Mao Zedong said, or Genghis Khan for that matter. A spectacle like that is going to make most men feel anxious and annoyed and upset. Al-Mamif felt not the slightest regret at having caused male club members to feel anxious and annoyed and upset. Such unpleasant feelings were nothing compared with the pain experienced by a victim of forcible rape. She could not defy her superior's orders, however, and so her self-defense class had to lower the level of their aggressiveness. She was also forbidden to use the doll. As a result, her drills became much more lukewarm and formal. Al-Mamif herself was hardly pleased by this, and several members raised objections. But as an employee, there was nothing she could do. It was Al-Mamif's opinion that, if she were unable to deliver an effective kick to the balls when forcibly attacked by a man, there would be very little else left for her to try. In the actual heat of combat, it was virtually impossible to perform such high-level techniques as grabbing your opponent's arm and twisting it behind his back. That only happened in the movies. Rather than attempting such a feat, a woman would be far better off running away without trying to fight. In any case, Al-Mamif had mastered at least 10 separate techniques for kicking men in the balls. She had even gone so far as to have several younger men she knew from college put on protective cups and let her practice on them. "Your kicks really hurt, even with the cup on," one of them had screamed in pain. "No more, please!" If the need arose, she knew she would never hesitate to apply her sophisticated techniques in actual combat. "If there's any guy crazy enough to attack me, I'm going to show him the end of the world, close up. I'm going to let him see the kingdom come with his own eyes. I'm going to send him straight to the southern hemisphere and let the ashes of death rain all over him and the kangaroos and the wallabies." As she pondered the coming of the kingdom, Al-Mamif sat at the bar, taking little sips of her Tom Collins. She would glance at her wristwatch every now and then, pretending that she was here to meet someone. But in fact, she had made no such arrangement. She was simply keeping an eye out for a suitable man among the bar's arriving patrons. Her watch said 8:30. She wore a pale blue blouse beneath a dark brown Calvin Klein jacket and a navy blue miniskirt. Her handmade ice pick was not with her today. It was resting peacefully, wrapped in a towel in her dresser drawer at home. This was a well-known singles bar in the Roppongi Entertainment District. Single men came here on the prowl for single women, or vice versa. A lot of them were foreigners. The bar was meant to look like a place where Hemingway might have hung out in the Bahamas. A stuffed swordfish hung on the wall, and fishing nets dangled from the ceiling. There were lots of photographs of people posing with giant fish they had caught. And there was a portrait of Hemingway. Happy Papa Hemingway. The people who came here were apparently not concerned that the author later suffered from alcoholism and killed himself with a hunting rifle. Several men approached Al-Mamif that evening, but none she liked. A pair of typically footloose college students invited her to join them, but she couldn't be bothered to respond. To a 30-ish company employee with creepy eyes, she said she was here to meet someone and turned him down flat. She just didn't like young men. They were so aggressive and self-confident, but they had nothing to talk about, and whatever they had to say was boring. In bed, they went at it like animals and had no clue about the true enjoyment of sex. She liked those slightly tired middle-aged men, preferably in the early stages of baldness. They should be clean and free of any hint of vulgarity. And they had to have well-shaped heads. Such men were not easy to find, which meant that she had to be willing to compromise. Scanning the room, Al-Mamif released a silent sigh. Why were there so damn few suitable men around? She thought about Sean Connery. Just imagining the shape of his head, she felt a dull throbbing deep inside. If Sean Connery were to suddenly pop up here, I would do anything to make him mine. Of course, there's no way in hell that Sean Connery is going to show his face in a Roppongi fake Bahama singles bar. On the bar's big wall television, Queen was performing. Ah, Mama didn't much like Queen's music. She tried her best not to look in that direction. She also tried hard not to listen to the music coming from the speakers. After the Queen video ended, ABBA came on. Oh, no. Something tells me this is going to be an awful night. Al Mame had met the Dowager of Willow House at the sports club where she worked. The woman was enrolled in Al Mame's self-defense class, the short-lived radical one that emphasized attacking the doll. She was a small woman, the oldest member of the class, but her movements were light and her kicks sharp. In a tight situation, I'm sure she could kick her opponent in the balls without the slightest hesitation. She never speaks more than necessary, and when she does speak, she never beats around the bush. Ah, Mama liked that about her. At my age, there's no special need for self-defense, the woman said to Ah, Mama with a dignified smile after class. Age has nothing to do with it, Ah, Mama snapped back. It's a question of how you live your life. The important thing is to adopt a stance of always being deadly serious about protecting yourself. You can't go anywhere if you just resign yourself to being attacked. A state of chronic powerlessness eats away at a person. The Dowager said nothing for a while, looking Ah-Mama in the eye. Either Ah-Mama's words or her tone of voice seemed to have made a strong impression on her. She nodded gravely. You're right. You are absolutely right, she said. You have obviously done some solid thinking about this. A few days later, Ah-Mama received an envelope. It had been left at the club's front desk for her. Inside, Ah-Mama found a short, beautifully penned note containing the Dowager's address and telephone number. I know you must be very busy, it said, but I would appreciate hearing from you sometime when you are free. A man answered the phone. A secretary, it seemed. When Ah-Mama gave her name, he switched her to an extension without a word. The Dowager came on the line and thanked her for calling. If it's not too much bother, I'd like to invite you out for a meal, she said. I'd like to have a nice long talk with you, just the two of us. With pleasure, Ah-Mama said. How would tomorrow night be for you? Ah-Mama had no problem with that, but she had to wonder what this elegant older woman could possibly want to speak about with someone like her. The two had dinner at a French restaurant in a quiet section of Azabu. The Dowager had been coming here for a long time, it seemed. They showed her to one of the better tables in the back, and she apparently knew the aging waiter who provided them with attentive service. She wore a beautifully cut dress of unfigured pale green cloth, perhaps a 1960s Givenchy, and a jade necklace. Midway through the meal, the manager appeared and offered her his respectful greetings. Vegetarian cuisine occupied much of the menu, and the flavors were elegant and simple. By coincidence, the soup of the day was green pea soup, as if in honor of Ah-Mama. The Dowager had a glass of Chablis, and Ah-Mama kept her company. The wine was just as elegant and simple as the food. Ah-Mama ordered a grilled cut of whitefish. The Dowager took only vegetables. Her manner of eating the vegetables was beautiful, like a work of art. When you get to be my age, you can stay alive eating very little, she said. Of the finest food possible, she added, half in jest. She wanted Ah-Mama to become her personal trainer, instructing her in martial arts at her home 2 or 3 days a week. Also, if possible, she wanted Ah-Mama to help her with muscle stretching. Of course I can do that, Ah-Mama said. but I'll have to ask you to arrange for the personal training away from the gym through the club's front desk. That's fine, the dowager said, but let's make scheduling arrangements directly. There is bound to be confusion if other people get involved. I'd like to avoid that. Would that be all right with you? Perfectly all right. Then let's start next week, the dowager said. This was all it took to conclude their business. The dowager said, I was tremendously struck by what you said at the gym the other day. About powerlessness. About how powerlessness inflicts such damage on people. Do you remember? Al-Mamin nodded. I do. Do you mind if I ask you a question? It will be a very direct question, to save time. Ask whatever you like, Al-Mamin said. Are you a feminist or a lesbian? Al-Mamin blushed slightly and shook her head. I don't think so. My thoughts on such matters are strictly my own. I'm not a doctor and feminist, and I'm not a lesbian. That's good, the dowager said. As if relieved, she elegantly lifted a forkful of broccoli to her mouth, elegantly chewed it, and took one small sip of wine. Then she said, Even if you were a feminist or a lesbian, it wouldn't bother me in the least. It wouldn't influence anything. But, if I may say so, your not being either will make it easier for us to communicate. Do you see what I'm trying to say? I do, Al-Mamin said. Al-Mamin went to the dowager's compound twice a week to guide her in martial arts. The dowager had a large, mirrored practice space built years earlier for her little daughter's ballet lessons, and it was there that she and Al-Mamin did their carefully ordered exercises. For someone her age, the dowager was very flexible, and she progressed rapidly. Hers was a small body, but one that had been well cared for over the years. Al-Mamin also taught her the basics of systematic stretching and gave her massages to loosen her muscles. Al-Mamin was especially skilled at deep tissue massage. She had earned better grades in that field than anyone else at the College of Physical Education. The names of all the bones and all the muscles of the human body were engraved in her brain. She knew the function and characteristics of each muscle, both how to tone it and how to keep it toned. It was Al-Mamin's firm belief that the human body was a temple, to be kept as strong and beautiful and clean as possible, whatever one might enshrine there. Not content with ordinary sports medicine, Al-Mamin learned acupuncture techniques as a matter of personal interest, taking formal training for several years from a Chinese doctor. Impressed with her rapid progress, the doctor told her that she had more than enough skill to be a professional. She was a quick learner, with an unquenchable thirst for detailed knowledge regarding the body's functions. But more than anything, she had fingertips that were endowed with an almost frightening sixth sense. Just as certain people possess perfect pitch, or the ability to find underground water veins, Al-Mamin's fingertips could instantly discern the subtle points on the body that influenced its functionality. This was nothing that anyone had taught her. It came to her naturally. Before long, Al-Mamin and the dowager would follow up their training and massage sessions with a leisurely chat over a cup of tea. Tamaru would always bring the tea utensils on the silver tray. He never spoke a word in Al-Mama's presence during the first month, until Al-Mamin felt compelled to ask the dowager if by chance Tamaru was incapable of speaking. One time, the dowager asked Al-Mamin if she had ever used her testicle-kicking technique in actual self-defense. Just once, Al-Mamin answered. Did it work? The dowager asked. It had the intended effect, Al-Mamin answered cautiously and concisely. Do you think it would work on Tamaru? Al-Mamin shook her head. Probably not. He knows about things like that. If the other person has the ability to read your movements, there's nothing you can do. The testicle kick only works with amateurs who have no actual fighting experience. In other words, you recognize that Tamaru is no amateur. How should I put it? Aomame paused. He has a special presence. He's not an ordinary person. The dowager added cream to her tea and stirred it slowly. So the man you kicked that time was an amateur, I assume. A big man? Aomame nodded, but did not say anything. The man had been well-built and strong-looking, but he was arrogant, and he had let his guard down with the mere woman. He had never had the experience of being kicked in the balls by a woman, and never imagined such a thing would ever happen to him. "Did he end up with any wounds?" the dowager asked. "No, no wounds," Aomame said. "He was just in intense pain for a while." The dowager remained silent for a moment. Then she asked, "Have you ever attacked a man before? Not just causing him pain, but intentionally wounding him?" "I have," Aomame replied. Lying was not a specialty of hers. "Can you talk about it?" Aomame shook her head almost imperceptibly. "I'm sorry, but it's not something I can talk about easily." "Of course not," the dowager said. "That's fine. There is no need to force yourself." The two drank their tea in silence, each with her own thoughts. Finally, the dowager spoke. "But sometime, when you feel like talking about it, do you think I might be able to have you tell me what happened back then?" Aomame said, "I might be able to tell you sometime. Or I might not, ever. I honestly don't know myself." The dowager looked at Aomame for a while. Then she said, "I'm not asking out of mere curiosity." Aomame kept silent. "As I see it, you are living with something that you keep hidden deep inside. Something heavy. I felt it from the first time I met you. You have a strong gaze, as if you have made up your mind about something. To tell you the truth, I myself carry such things around inside. Heavy things. That is how I can see it in you. There is no need to hurry, but you will be better off at some point in time if you bring it outside yourself. I am nothing if not discreet, and I have several realistic measures at my disposal. If all goes well, I could be of help to you." Later, when Aomame finally opened up to the dowager, she would also open a new door in her life.
"Hey, what are you drinking?" someone asked near Aomame's ear.
The voice belonged to a woman. Aomame raised her head and looked at the speaker. A young woman with a 50-style ponytail was sitting on the neighboring bar stool. Her dress had a tiny flower pattern, and a small Gucci bag hung from her shoulder. Her nails were carefully manicured in pale pink. By no means fat, the woman was round everywhere, including her face, which radiated a truly friendly warmth, and she had big breasts. Aomame was somewhat taken aback. She had not been expecting to be approached by a woman. This was a bar for men to approach women.
"Tom Collins," Aomame said.
"Is it good?"
"Not especially, but it's not that strong, and I can sip it."
"I wonder why they call it Tom Collins."
"I have no idea," Aomame said. "Maybe it's the name of the guy who invented it. Not that it's such an amazing invention."
The woman waved to the bartender and said,
"I'll have a Tom Collins, too."
A few minutes later, she had her drink.
"Mind if I sit here?" she asked.
"Not at all. It's an empty seat."
"And you're already sitting in it," Aomame thought without speaking the words.
"You don't have a date to meet anybody here, do you?" the woman asked.
Instead of answering, Aomame studied the woman's face.
She guessed the woman was 3 or 4 years younger than herself.
"Don't worry, I'm not interested in that," the woman whispered, as if sharing a secret. "If that's what you're worried about, I prefer men too, like you."
"Like me?"
"Well, isn't that why you came here? To find a guy?"
"Do I look like that?"
The woman narrowed her eyes somewhat.
"That much is obvious. It's what this place is for, and I'm guessing that neither of us is a pro."
"Of course not," Almama said. "Hey, here's an idea. Why don't we team up? It's probably easier for a man to approach two women than one, and we can relax more and sort of feel safer if we're together instead of alone. We look so different, too. I'm more the womanly type, and you have that trim, boyish style. I'm sure we're a good match."
"Boyish," Almama thought. "That's the first time anyone's ever called me that."
"Our taste in men might be different, though," she said. "How's that supposed to work if we're a team?"
The woman pursed her lips and thought.
"True, now that you mention it. Taste in men, huh? What kind do you like?"
"Middle-aged, if possible," Almama said.
"I'm not that into young guys. I like 'em when they're just starting to lose their hair."
"Wow, I get it. Middle-aged, huh? I like 'em young and lively and good-looking. I'm not much interested in middle-aged guys, but I'm willing to go along with you and give it a try. It's all experience."
"Are middle-aged guys good?"
"At sex, I mean."
"It depends on the guy," Almama said.
"Of course,"
the woman replied. Then she narrowed her eyes, as if verifying some kind of theory.
"You can't generalize about sex, of course, but if you were to say overall, they're not bad. They eventually run out of steam. But while they're at it, they take their time. They don't rush it. When they're good, they can make you come a lot."
The woman gave this some thought.
I may be getting interested. Maybe I'll try that out."
"You should."
"Say, have you ever tried four-way sex? You switch partners at some point?"
"Never."
"I haven't either. Interested?"
"Probably not," Almama said. I don't mind teaming up, but if we're going to do stuff together, even temporarily, can you tell me a little more about yourself? Because we could be on completely different wavelengths."
"Good idea," she said. "So what do you want to know about me?"
"Well, for one thing, what kind of work do you do?"
The woman took a drink of her Tom Collins and set it down on the coaster. Then she dabbed at her lips with a paper napkin. Then she examined the lipstick stains on the napkin.
"This is a pretty good drink," she said.
"It has a gin base, right?"
"Gin and lemon juice and soda water.
True, it's no great invention, but it tastes pretty good."
"I'm glad."
"So then, what kind of work do I do? Well, it's kind of tough. Even if I tell you the truth, you might not believe me."
"So I'll go first," Almama said. "I'm an instructor at a sports club. I mostly teach martial arts. Also muscle stretching."
"Martial arts? Like Bruce Lee kind of stuff?"
"Kind of."
"Are you good at it?"
"Okay." The woman smiled and raised her glass as if in a toast.
"So in a pinch, we might be an unbeatable team. I might not look it, but I've been doing Aikido for years. To tell you the truth, I'm a policewoman."
"A policewoman?" Almama's mouth dropped open, but no further words emerged from it.
"Tokyo Metropolitan Police Department. I don't look the part, do I?"
"Certainly not," Almama said.
"It's true, though. Absolutely. My name is Ayumi."
"I'm Almame."
"Almame? Is that your real name?"
Almame gave her a solemn nod. "A policewoman? You mean you wear a uniform and carry a gun and ride in a police car and patrol the streets?"
"That's what I'd like to be doing. It's what I joined the police force to do, but they won't let me, Ayumi said.
She took a handful of pretzels from a nearby bowl and started munching them noisily.
I wore a ridiculous uniform, ride around in one of those mini patrol cars, basically a motor scooter, and give parking tickets all day. They won't let me carry a pistol, of course. There's no need to fire warning shots at a local citizen who's parked his Toyota Corolla in front of a fire hydrant. I got great marks at shooting practice, but nobody gives a damn about that. Just because I'm a woman, they've got me going around with a piece of chalk on a stick, writing the time and license plate numbers on the asphalt day after day.
Speaking of pistols, do you fire a Beretta semi-automatic?
Sure. They're all Berettas now. They're a little too heavy for me. Fully loaded, they probably weigh close to a kilogram.
The body of a Beretta alone weighs 850 grams, Almame said. Ayumi looked at Almame like a pawnbroker assessing a wristwatch.
How do you know something like that? She asked.
I've always had an interest in guns, Almame said. Of course, I've never actually fired one.
Oh, really?
Ayumi seemed convinced.
I'm really into shooting pistols. True, a Beretta is heavy, but it has less of a recoil than the older guns, so even a small woman can handle one with enough practice. The top guys don't believe it, though. They're convinced that a woman can't handle a pistol. All the higher-ups in the department are male chauvinist fascists. I had super grades in nightstick techniques, too. At least as good as most of the men, but I got no recognition at all. The only thing I ever heard from them was filthy double entendres. Say, you really know how to grab that nightstick. Let me know anytime you want some extra practice. Stuff like that. Their brains are like a century and a half behind the times.
Ayumi took a pack of Virginia Slims from her shoulder bag, and with practiced movements eased a cigarette from the pack, put it between her lips, lit it with a slim gold lighter, and slowly exhaled the smoke toward the ceiling. "Whatever gave you the idea of becoming a police officer?" Almame asked.
"I never intended to," Ayumi replied. "But I didn't want to do ordinary office work, and I didn't have any professional skills. That really limited my options. So in my senior year of college, I took the Metropolitan Police Employment Exam. A lot of my relatives were cops. My father, my brother, one of my uncles. The police are a kind of nepotistic society, so it's easier to get hired if you're related to a policeman.
The police family.
Exactly. Until I actually got into it, though, I had no idea how rife the place was with gender discrimination. Female officers are more or less second-class citizens in the police world. The only jobs they give you to do are handling traffic violations, shuffling papers at a desk, teaching safety education at elementary schools, or patting down female suspects. Boring. Meanwhile, guys who clearly have less ability than me are sent out to one interesting crime scene after another. The higher-ups talk about equal opportunity for the sexes, but it's all a front. It just doesn't work that way. It kills your desire to do a good job. You know what I mean?
All Mama said she understood.
It makes me so mad.
Don't you have a boyfriend or something? All Mama asked. Ayumi frowned. For a while, she glared at the slim cigarette between her fingers.
It's nearly impossible for a policewoman to have a boyfriend. You work irregular hours, so it's hard to coordinate times with anyone who works a normal business week. And even if things do start to work out, the minute an ordinary guy hears you're a cop, he just scoots away like a crab running from the surf. It's awful, don't you think?
Almame said that she did think it was awful.
Which leaves a workplace romance as the only possibility. Except there aren't any decent men there. They're all brain-dead jerks who can only tell dirty jokes. They're either born stupid, or they think of nothing else but their advancement. And these are the guys responsible for the safety of society? Japan does not have a bright future.
Somebody as cute as you should be popular with the men, I would think, Almame said.
Well, I'm not exactly unpopular. as long as I don't reveal my profession. So in places like this, I just tell them I work for an insurance company. Do you come here often? Not often. Once in a while, Ayumi said. After a moment's reflection, she said, as if revealing a secret, Every now and then, I start craving sex. To put it bluntly, I want a man.